You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and thank you for listening to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University here in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today in the studio, and by studio, of course, I mean my office, is John Whitehead. John Whitehead is an SBU graduate as well as a Harvard Law graduate and was on the team of attorneys who helped defend or prosecute, I'm not sure what the right word is there, the Missouri Trinity Lutheran case.
We were plaintiffs and petitioners.
Plaintiffs and petitioners. There we go. John, thanks for joining us in the studio, our wonderfully comfortable studio here.
Happy to be here. I've spent many, many hours in rooms just like this at SBU, so good to be back.
Yeah, and it's great to have you. John talked to my class earlier today, and we had a good time talking about this very case. So I'm sorry you have to talk about this twice in one day. Can you just walk us through the facts of the case?
Sure. So Trinity Lutheran involves, obviously, Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri. There's a little suburban church. And the church has, at the back of it, a center, a preschool education center. It had originally been a separate corporation the church had run, but then had merged back in with the church at some point. It has a little school building with preschool classrooms. And then they have a pretty good-sized pea gravel playground. And the playground sits kind of at the back of the school building. So it's separated from the main church by the school building. The facility is obviously there for the use of preschool children, but it's also open to the community, at least when it's not in use, certain hours on the weekends. So it's really, the school thinks of it as a community resource. In 2012, members of the school applied to the Missouri Department of Natural Resources for a scrap a tire rubber grant. So Missouri, if you buy new tires in Missouri, you chip in a 50-cent fee per tire into the kitty, and Missouri Department of Natural Resources tries to use that to take tires out of landfills. That's the main goal, obviously. And the scrap tire program kind of killed two or three birds with one stone. The program was intended to help nonprofit preschools resurface their playgrounds using those recycled tires. So part of the way the fee was used was to rebate part of the purchase price, not all, but part of a nonprofit preschool's or nonprofit school's purchase of safer playground material. If you're familiar with playground materials, sometimes there's mulch, sometimes there's hard concrete, sometimes there's rubber mulch, but the particular surface at issue here was not rubber mulch, but what they call a pour-in rubber surface, which looks a little bit like rubber asphalt. So it's a kind of a hard mat you might have seen in various preschools.
Like pickup liners, basically.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's similar to that. Yeah, almost that same consistency. That was the plan, was that the state would underwrite part of that cost to make it more cost competitive. That would get tires out of Missouri landfills and accomplish the program purposes that way. And then I think another requirement was that you had to purchase it from a Missouri business. So it also helped Missouri jobs. So it accomplished several governmental purposes all in one fell swoop.
And if I were a libertarian, I would have many, many objections to basically everything you've said so far. But I'm not, so let's.
Sure, sure. A recurring question is, should the government be in this business? But the answer is, it's here. If there's going to be waste tires in the state, maybe the state has a good interest in getting those out of the landfill. Should it be doing this for private schools? At least some states might say, well, we would just give this to public schools, right? We would just resurface public education in Missouri. But for good governmental purposes, there were outfits besides schools they assisted. They wanted to help generally nonprofit organizations. Now, I will say, some people said, well, these are nonprofits and they don't pay taxes and they shouldn't be a part of this program. But in Missouri, at least this fee, the 50-cent fee, gets paid by everybody. It's not just paid by taxpayers. If you're a business or if you're a nonprofit or if you're a church, the church had chipped in its 50 cents when it changed tires on church vans or church buses. So this was a fee that everybody pays, and the legislature decided it could be paid back out to nonprofits.
Right. And so the objection doesn't come in from some kind of oppressive hand of government. It actually comes from our state constitution. Article 1, Section 7, and I believe you got that in front of you. Do you want to go ahead and read that for
right.
us?
So I guess I'll – to fast forward, the Trinity Lutheran applies for the program and is ultimately rejected. They meet all the criteria but are rejected. In fact, they're told they're fourth out of 55 grants that year.
In the list of priorities.
Right. Yeah. Everyone else submits their grants. They're ranked by competitive criteria, and so they end up number 5 out of 44, if I said 44 correctly. So they end up 5 out of 44, but then they are subject to judicial review by the lawyers in the department, and they get notice that they've been rejected. And the claim for rejection cites Missouri's special constitutional provision. It cited Article 1, Section 7 of the Missouri Constitution. That's one of Missouri's several clauses dealing with religion, but it ends up being perhaps the most litigated provision. So you want me to read that?
Please read.
Into the record. Article 1, Section 7 says that no money shall ever be taken from the public treasury, directly or indirectly, in aid of any church, sect, or denomination of religion, or in aid of any priest, preacher, minister, or teacher thereof as such, and that no preference shall be given to nor any discrimination made against any church, sect, or creed of religion, or any form of religious faith or worship.
Yeah, so how is this a violation of something, right? I guess what's the nature of the lawsuit here?
Right, so usually we talk about religion and constitutional issues. People think, well, it's involving the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Maybe it's involving one of those clauses. But the state of Missouri, at least, admitted the federal constitution would clearly allow the state of Missouri to have a program that funded safety improvements and to write those checks directly to churches if they met other criteria. So the state could offer a program that says all nonprofits can apply, and if a church applied, it would not violate the federal constitution, the state of Missouri admitted, for the state to grant that program. Missouri, in a long line of cases, has said we have a higher wall of separation of church and state in Missouri. That was the claim. We are more protective of that wall and separation, and therefore in Missouri we have a strict non-funding, either directly or indirectly, principle. That was the claim. Now, lots of cases had, in fact, eroded that claim. There seemed to be broad consensus that Missouri couldn't deny universal services, entitlements, just based on religious status or religious the person applying. But they also, it would show up in odd places. It would show up across the board in cases involving people trying to be religious in public. And so there have been several cases that have litigated this particular provision.
And what happened once the lawsuit? Walk us sort of through the narrative through the court.
Well, I told the class today, I said, of course, this seems like one of those cases in which you hope a few letters would resolve this, a few phone calls, but those are always the ones that end up going to the Supreme Court, it seems. The church contacted Alliance Defending Freedom, who's a nonprofit public interest law firm that is focused on defending religious liberty in the public square.
And a hate group, right?
No, they're not a hate group.
Southern I read on the internet.
The Southern Poverty Law Center does make claims about groups, but Alliance for Freedom is not, in fact, a hate group. I've been involved with them long enough to know what they believe and advocate, and the stuff SLPC has put forward is just not fair.
I should also point out that my wife has been associated with this group, so not a hate group. That was a joke. No lawsuits, please.
Right. Yeah. No. ADF has been around a long time. They are one of the preeminent First Amendment litigation public interest firms in the country. It really is amazing to watch these cases get prepped. I told the class my father was involved in a religious liberty case back in the early 1980s, Widmar versus Vincent. And at that time, the religious liberty bar was non-existent, or largely non-existent. There were a few practitioners. But groups like Alliance Defending Freedom and some others in the past decade have really put some real investment into making sure these cases get the hearing they deserve. And it was a lot of fun to be involved in watching this one get worked up and argued.
So we've got big national special interest group squaring off against the state of Missouri, right? Title fight.
Something like that, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Where do we go once you guys get involved? What then?
Well, so at that point, one of the undercurrents in the case is Missouri politics. At that point, Chris Koster was the attorney general, who was eyeing a governor in 2016, and Chris, for whatever reason, decided this was an issue they didn't want to move on, and so it goes to trial court in Jefferson City. And the religious folks lose pretty badly. There's long opinion issued, and they say this has always been the way in Missouri, and the Supreme Court has said states have the right to have slightly higher walls. They have the right to draw these lines a little bit differently. And Missouri's drawn its line at never paying a check to a church directly. That's their line, and they're entitled to it, and the church is out of luck on this claim. And then upon appeal to the Eighth Circuit, a three-judge panel decides, again, against the church. There's an en banc, a motion for en banc hearing that gets denied.
Which is the whole circuit, right?
Which is the whole circuit. Right. But out of that comes a pretty good dissent from the denial that kind of lays out how this constitutional provision lays in history, its status as a Blaine Amendment, and also talks about the conflict between the circuits, and ultimately cert is granted by the Supreme Court.
Right, so we get to the Supreme Court, and then some odd things happen in terms of your course through the court after cert is granted.
Right, it is the most roller coaster ride of a case. Cert is granted. Of course, when you lose at the Eighth Circuit, in most cases, the Supreme Court doesn't take your case. So the fact the Supreme Court agrees to take the case, of course, gives the church petitioners great hope. And then shortly after the court takes the case, Justice Scalia dies. And that calls into question, well, you know, there goes one of the votes of folks who might be sympathetic to religion in public life, or at least have a view that would support the church in this case. And so then you start to question, well, what's going to happen? We're several months away from an election.
Right.
President Obama nominates Merrick Garland to that seat. And so you start thinking, well, what will the Justice Garland think about this kind of case? What arguments will he find receptive? And then the Republican Congress decides they're not going to approve and not going to give Justice Garland a hearing. And so then you start thinking about, well, what does a President Clinton, who's she going to appoint? What will her justice think about this? Is it Merrick Garland or somebody even more perhaps liberal?
Meanwhile, lots of 4-4 decisions are coming out.
That's right, lots of 4-4 ties, and Trina Lutheran is not getting scheduled for argument. And so one of the thoughts behind that is, internally they think this might be a 4-4 case. And so if Justice Scalia was, in fact, the deciding vote, whoever replaces him obviously becomes a really big issue.
Right.
And then lo and behold, of course, it wasn't President Clinton. It is President Trump. And then the question becomes, who on earth is Donald Trump going to appoint to the Supreme Court? And early on, there was lots of talk about Marianne Trump, his sister, maybe being a nominee.
That was my prediction. I was wrong.
But
there you go.
But lots of folks just had no idea who he would select. And so we get Neil Gorsuch, who ends up on his first full week of arguments participating in the Trinity Lutheran argument. So we got these ups and downs and changes about who's going to hear the case, what are the arguments. If it's really a 5-4 case, that next justice becomes really important.
Right.
Understanding their history. And frankly, we had not had an establishment clause, a pure establishment clause case out of Neil Gorsuch before he reached the court. So at least in my mind, there was a real question. He had interpreted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act true to its statutory language, and that seems to be what he enjoys doing. But if there's no riff for a question, which there wasn't in this case, what does Justice Gorsuch think about the actual First Amendment to the Constitution?
Right.
So it remained a real question mark, even as arguments were heard in this case in April.
And of course, all of the political circumstances changed in Missouri as well. So. Also a factor in the case.
Yeah,
which may be less relevant for our national listeners, but still important.
Well, I think it was interesting. It did attract national attention because the other sidelight issue I mentioned, Chris Koster started out the Attorney General for Missouri in this case, but he was up. That office was vacant. He was going to run for governor, and so there was a battle for Attorney General. And one of the candidates for Attorney General was Joshua Hawley, and Josh had worked for the Beckett Fund. Which is another national religious liberty firm. He was part of the team that helped present the Hobby Lobby case to the Supreme Court. So he was a well-known religious liberty litigator. In fact, in the run-up to Trinity Lutheran, had filed a brief on behalf of the AG, and not the Attorney General's office, but the Assemblies of God. And so he was quite openly on the record favoring the position of the church and in his view, said that Missouri's constitutional provision, the way it was being interpreted, was unconstitutional. So he was already on the record saying that. And so there was he had actually clerked for the Chief Justice. And so there was a question, well, maybe the court is waiting to see what happens with this election. And if Josh Hawley wins, what will that do to the case? Josh ultimately does win. He does move into the office, but ultimately decides that he's conflicted out because of his prior position in litigation, so he hands it to other staff, and the staff ultimately reaches out to Jim Layton, James Layton, who's now a litigator in St. Louis, but had been the Solicitor General for Missouri for a long time. So we'll talk about kind of the argument later, but I think some folks said, well, you know, maybe Josh Hawley or somebody is putting up somebody who really doesn't believe in this case. And as somebody who's been a Missouri lawyer for a long, long time, I can assure you, Jim Layton, this was exactly the same thing he would have argued no matter who was Attorney General.
Right.
He had argued it for a long time. It was a winning argument in Missouri courts for a long time.
Right.
So they really did pick the best person to make the argument out of the Missouri cases that they possibly could.
And so the case goes to the court. The arguments are held. I do want to get to the opinions on the case. But mm-hmm. anything that jumps out about these particular arguments, which of course we'll throw a link up in the show notes. You can listen to the oral arguments online. They're available just for download or whatever. Anything that we should particularly pay attention to there?
Well, I mean, certainly when you're experiencing them real time, the question is always, what questions am I going to get? Which way is the court leaning? I think the biggest sigh of relief early on. The other political thing we did not mention was that the week before the case was argued, Governor Greitens, who's the new governor of Missouri, had issued literally a Facebook post on Friday afternoon before the argument that he was going to change his office's policy, or at least the governor's policy on this constitutional amendment, and he was going to order DNR to strike any language from the application that might exclude churches. And so that was clearly we understood the governor's position, and that was probably a position we agreed with. Unfortunately, you can't change the Missouri Constitution with a Friday afternoon Facebook post. As laudable as the outcome was, that was still going to present a big issue for not just state level government, but look, that bars counties, municipalities as
right.
well. And we've seen this issue come up enough at that level as well. This interpretation of Missouri was well grounded in case law. It had been adopted across the board by counties and other state officials. So it wasn't going to answer the issue. But there were lots of other folks on the other side, especially, that said, no, that makes this case moot. And it doesn't technically make the case moot. The Supreme Court gets to hear what it wants to decide.
Right.
Pretty clearly, the Supreme Court has said you can't have a situation where one side can change their mind every other day and get rid of cases that way. We're not going to let cases go up, and one side changes their mind, we're going to put the burden on them to show that they can't change their mind again.
Right.
And so that met the standard here. All that to say, it was a relief. Everyone spent their weekend briefing this issue, submitting letters back to the court with their positions on these cases. It was a relief to hear Justice Ginsburg pretty quickly say, I think we all agree this case is not moot. And I don't think Justice Sotomayor agreed, but to hear Justice Ginsburg say that, that meant we were going to get a hearing on the merits, and that was a relief.
Now, did the line actually get withdrawn from the DNR application?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so it is.
So yeah, I think there was a line at the bottom of the page that said, you know, churches won't be considered, but as I understand it now, that line has been deleted.
And of course, you'd have the issue of a state governor not wanting to enforce the state constitution would also be.
Right. Yeah. Missouri has really very open taxpayer standing rules. So in the past, whenever a state official has tried to test this issue, pretty quickly, they get sued by a group that's opposed to that kind of funding. So he would have been sued. It would have been in state court, maybe federal court. And under Missouri law, he probably would have lost, frankly.
And would we be right back to where we're at now?
Just 4 years later with different parties and different facts, right? So the court was right to take it up. But as I said, they get to hear what they want to hear.
Sure.
And anytime somebody a week before a case has been pending several years now, working with the system, anytime you get that kind of outside shock, that's not something you particularly want to have to deal with. But it worked out, and I'm obviously happy with the outcome.
Now, in terms of the arguments themselves, like the actual the hour-long back and forth, anything we should know there, or just go listen to it?
Yeah, do go listen to it. I mean, like I said, you'll probably almost audibly hear our relief when Justice Ginsburg is there. I told the class earlier, it is interesting the cases some cases you listen to and there are not a lot of questions. It's kind of a dead courtroom. The briefs have done the case justice, and so the justices don't ask a lot of questions. Religion cases, it tends to be an active bench. So there's lots of questions. Everyone has a question. Everyone has a point of view. Everyone has a thought about how religion fits into American life on the Constitution. They are active questions. They're rapid fire. They come from both sides of the bench. So it's always fun to listen to those cases. Of course, the courtroom is full.
Right.
On these cases. It's not an empty courtroom. Some days you can walk in pretty late and get a seat, and this was not one of those days.
Sure.
Certainly, it was a relief once we heard Jim Layton stand up, because I think the court pretty quickly understood the potential scope of Missouri's rule, which was, do you mean to tell us, even with safety concerns, the state has a legitimate interest in saying we will not extend those safety programs to churches based solely on religious status? Granted, we understand you don't want to fund religious activities, perhaps. The state probably has a strong interest in not funding revival services, right? You're not going to fund a traveling religious education minister to go preach in the highways and byways of Missouri. That's a private religious activity.
Right.
But if you're really going to start drawing the line at indirect or even direct support of churches, when the government concern is the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens, and that concern has nothing to do with the religious status of where they are, the government just wants to protect you wherever you are. And if the state of Missouri took the position that it really could start denying health and safety benefits based solely on the fact it was a church, that raises really troubling questions about making churches and religious believers really outside government protection.
Right.
And I think they caught on that fairly quickly. I told the class, Justice Breyer usually has at least one long hypo. You probably don't want to be the recipient of that hypo. And he gave that long hypo to Jim Layton. And we were glad to see that.
Well, of the opinions of the case, maybe, so again, I want to get into the substance in some of the issues a bit, but can you just walk us briefly maybe through the dissents? Were there any concurring opinions? I don't remember.
There was. Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch have a concurrence, and then Justice Gorsuch, I believe, writes his own. Yeah.
All right, so why don't you just briefly, and you know, one line or even pass on one if you think it's not interesting or relevant. Give us the dissents and the concurrences, and then we'll dive into the majority.
So Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch, I think the most notable thing about that, of course, this is Justice Gorsuch is one of his first written opinions,
right.
Even though it's a concurrence. He says, I question whether the line the court draws here, because the court only says, we're not going to let you discriminate based on religious status. He asked this question. He says, I think that's a hard line to police. And I don't want, he wanted to be sure that people understood that he was not voting for the proposition that this was where it stopped.
Right.
These principles were broader than what this case discussed. Justice Gorsuch says, it's not clear to me whether a religious man begins his meal with prayer or whether he begins it in a religious manner, right? So it's not clear if we're talking about a religious activity versus a religious status, whether or
right.
not that's an entirely policeable line. So that's the kind of right side of the bench concurrences. Justice Sotomayor writes a very lengthy dissent and is really pretty direct. And in fact, it ends, I dissent instead of I respectfully dissent. So some commentators noted that and thought she was pretty firm in her belief that this case had been decided the wrong way. And she goes kind of through the history and really tries to put the amendment not in the context of perhaps the Civil War era, the parties had disagreed about whether this was a Blaine amendment. We'll talk about that in a minute, I
right.
assume. Or whether this really arose out of the founding era concerns about church funding. And what was Missouri's intention behind this? Was it a good purpose or a discriminatory purpose? She came down firmly on the side of there was non-discriminatory purpose. And that, in fact, no matter what the state of Missouri said, she thought it was a establishment clause violation to cut the check to the church, regardless of what the state had said. She thought the court should have found it to be establishment clause violation. But she was the only, I take that back.
Herr Ginsburg. Right?
Only two votes for that proposition.
Which I will say as I disagree with it, but I can at least be a little bit heartened by the desire to look back at the founders and see some intent there in this particular case. That's not common necessarily from Sotomayor.
Yeah, well, whatever you want to say about Antonin Scalia's life, we all talk about the cases and the language now and the intent of the founders. We don't talk about nearly as much about social purpose,
right.
And that is an advance.
Even if that's what we're really doing.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's, surely there's some folks hiding that, but at least the discourse is framed in terms of what the language is.
Well, the majority opinion then, why don't you tell us a little bit about Blaine amendments and then what on earth Justice Roberts, right, has
sure.
to say about it.
Yeah, so Chief Justice Roberts writes the majority opinion. I think it's key to note that it is a 7-2 opinion, so that Justices Breyer and Kagan join the majority. I frankly expected some kind of split, whether that's a 3-3 or something like that. So it was a surprise, a pleasant surprise to see it to be a group opinion with more than five justices supporting it. And so it ultimately concludes that whatever Missouri's interests in avoiding appearances of funding religion are, that it can't discriminate against a church solely because it's a church in the issuance of a government program of this nature. And there'll be questions about what the scope of this opinion is. There's a footnote 3. Lots of folks said, well, it seems to explicitly say we're not deciding certain future cases about direct funding of education or religious education.
Right. Right.
But at least on this program, this kind of program, where the state is drawing lines just based on religious status. So no matter what the church is doing, no matter how it interplays with government, no matter what the government interest is, we're just going to cut churches out wholesale. that, the court rules, is an Establishment Clause violation.
Okay, and Blaine Amendments, did you want to talk about that at all, or do you want to just pass on that?
I think it's really, this is not a Missouri history podcast, though, right?
No. It's not just Missouri, though. Right?
Well, and true, it's not particularly a Missouri, not solely a Missouri issue.
I mean, Blaine was from Maine.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right, so Blaine was a senator back just after the Civil War, and he probably gets a little bit of a bad rap in that Blaine was doing what the party wanted him to do, or at least he was a presidential candidate, and this was kind of a popular idea.
Right.
And really, if you go back and trace it, probably the genesis is Ulysses Grant, who comes up with the idea, in fact goes to Iowa in the 1870s and gives a speech in which he calls for the federal Constitution to be amended so that it's ensured that public schools, which were a new idea then, public schools were expanding across the country, he wanted to be sure that no government money ever went to sectarian purposes. But by sectarian, he clearly meant Catholics.
Right.
He meant Catholic schools shouldn't receive a penny of government money. And let me see if I've got the language here. So he starts praising the free school, by which he means public schools. He says, "If we are to have another contest in the near future of our natural existence, I predict that the dividing line will not be Masons and Dixons, but between patriotism and intelligence on the one side, and superstition, ambition, and ignorance on the other." If you're there at the time, you understand that means if there's going to be another civil war, it's between Protestants and Catholics. Those are all code words for the view of many Protestants at that point about Catholics. So he says, "Let us all labor to add all needful guarantees for the more perfect security of free thought. Encourage free schools and resolve that not $1 of money appropriated to their support, no matter how raised, shall be appropriated to the support of any sectarian school. Resolve that either the state or the nation, or both combined, shall support institutions of learning sufficient to afford every child growing up in the land the opportunity of a good common school education, unmixed with sectarian, pagan, or atheistical tenets." So this begins as a campaign speech by Grant, who says, "Let's resolve that not a dollar of state or federal money will go to sectarian education." But by sectarian education, he meant, let's make sure the Catholics and the pagans and the atheists are kept out of public schools. That was the campaign slogan, the reason for the campaign slogan. And so Blaine, on behalf of lots of interests, offers up that as an amendment to the federal Constitution. Senator from Maine, and he was a potential nominee for the party, offers that up in Congress, and it gets voted down. Doesn't pass in Congress. But this campaign slogan-style language ends up in lots of state constitutions.
Right.
So a question for Missouri was, why is this language here, and is it one of the Blaine amendments? Was it because of Blaine? And the answer is, well, this part is, but that became a secondary issue probably at the argument. But clearly, those provisions in lots of states are blocking charter school provisions. Folks are saying you can't have charter provisions that would require or let the state indirectly fund private religious education. So that is a recurring issue, these Blaine amendments. And certainly I think Catholics are rightly upset that these provisions exist in state constitutions. I think there is some anti-Catholic reasons for them to be in there, and the history of them is not all that good. Missouri's has kind of a winding path as to how various portions of its constitution get into place. Article 1, Section 7 is half and half. Part of it was there in 1865, right, and part of it was added in 1875. The language in Trinity was 1875, so it came later, about the same time Grant makes a speech, that same summer.
So anything else over the sort of substance of the case? Otherwise, I want to ask a couple of questions and push back a little bit on all of the work you've done.
Sure. Yeah. No. That's fine.
without saying that I disagree with the outcome necessarily. I guess two sort of constitutional questions that I would ask. First, I'm largely a originalist textualist, whatever phrase you want to sort of throw together to say I'm on Scalia's side for the most part when it comes to interpreting the Constitution. And yet when I read the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, it seems to say Congress shall make no law doing X, Y, and Z things about speech and religion and so on, which to me implies that if state governments want to do so, they can. So something like the state churches that exist at the beginning of the 19th century, I would say those are, as a Baptist, I think they're unwise, and I think they're a bad idea. They're not unconstitutional. So from that read, it would seem that this Article 7, Section 7 of Article 1, the Missouri Constitution, is perfectly consistent with the First Amendment. How am I wrong there as an originalist?
Well, I mean, there is an ongoing, you're right, I have heard folks say, well, if Missouri wanted to establish church today, maybe they could. I think that's the case.
Or unestablished, right? This is going the other direction.
Or unestablished, right?
So this is the extreme other direction.
Right, but to say the First Amendment does not apply to the states, clearly the court has incorporated almost all those provisions against the states.
So we're setting aside a century of jurisprudence that I think is bad constitutional reasoning, but it exists.
It exists. It is true. The Supreme Court has said these amendments do protect citizens against their state governments as well. And you can argue about how they got there and what the path is for those to have got there. No church or no state has tried to have a state religion any time
since
the 1830s. So I guess in theory it's an open question as to how the court would rule, although I don't think it is. Clearly the court would say that our federal constitution now applies to the state governments. It's been incorporated against the states to its fullest extent. And so the First Amendment means neither the state or the federal government will be establishing religion at either level.
Right, which I guess part of my hesitation with just embracing that is, that's the same thing the other side is arguing. We're just arguing about application, right? We're saying, yeah, we all agree that the First Amendment applies to the states, but our interpretation of it is right and yours is wrong, and that's where I sort of am a little hesitant. I'm saying, well, wait a second, that doesn't seem to be what the amendment says. It says it all in the first place, and second, if we're agreeing on the methodology, then it's just a sort of a question of power, and whoever has the most votes on their side is going to win.
Yes, although I think the Baptist in me also strongly believes it is not just it's not just because I like it the way it is. Right, I'm not a Baptist because I believe Baptists are right to refuse government assistance in some cases.
Right,
it's because I believe it is true that as a prudential principle, church should not be supported by government or vice versa. So to enforce that rule, to me, is consistent with the spirit of what the founders intended, even though they didn't, granted, I think as a textual matter, you at first blush you say, well, this doesn't apply directly to the states, and so you have to explain, well, how it finally got there. But it is also true, at the same time, you have Leland in Virginia and elsewhere arguing state government should have the same rule. And,
right.
And Jefferson adopts that same rule.
And that leads to my second question,
right,
which in some ways hopefully is a better question. I'm willing to agree that this Section 7 of the Missouri Constitution needs to be changed. So why not change it? Like, why not deal with this at the state level? Why bring in the federal, as a states' rights guy, there's part of me that says, look, why drop the nuke on our state constitution with the federal government? Why not just deal with this in-house? As a Baptist, I'm going to say, okay, let's keep them separate, of course. But as someone who values, state sovereignty and the integrity of the state constitution and so on, why not pass an amendment? Which, in Missouri, you sneeze too hard and an amendment passes. Like, it's very easy to do here.
Well, of course, that's not always been the case. And certainly part of the reason these are in the Bill of Rights sections, right? And
right.
So in lots of ways, the Bill of Rights is meant to give minority groups of some stripe, right, people who are perhaps not going to be able to go to the majority and convince them of these principles. They give them a redress against government overreach.
Right.
And for better or for worse, Missouri courts, had been offered various interpretations of this amendment that might have lessened the impact, but pretty consistently had said, "Now we're gonna interpret this really to a pretty significant extent." For example, there's an "as such" in the amendment that applies to ministers. It says you're not going to support ministers as such. Well, arguably, maybe they thought that could have applied to churches as well. I think folks had offered up that argumentation that had largely been rejected by the courts. No, it really means what it says. No support for churches directly or indirectly. So I think the combination of you have what amount to minority religious groups, right? There's not a majority in Missouri sufficient to amend the Constitution that believes in those principles, perhaps. That's the thinking. Why do we let anyone bring these cases about bad constitutional state constitutional provisions? The answer is sometimes majoritarian government, if we're talking about the rights of the minority,
right,
to push back against the state government of the people, obviously the state government to some degree represents its people. And so at least in Missouri, you've had lots of political office holders that for good reasons or bad, for good Baptist reasons or anti-Catholic reasons, have supported a really hard line, what appears to be a hard line rule. I mean, I think part of the background issue again is Catholics and certain minority groups felt that this law was never quite applied as harshly to Protestants
as it was certainly to Catholics. True.
Right. So I think there is a real question in with those kinds of facts. Is there political power, and do you want to require them to go do that in the state?
Which again brings us back to sort of the Scalia objection of, look, just because you might lose that way, is that really a legitimate reason not to use the processes that exist for that purpose? Again, why go the other, why do the thing that, you know, my side is always accusing the left of doing? Because in this case we win, well, again, there's that methodological problem at the background.
Yeah, I mean, I guess because I'm a litigator, I'm a practical realist. Sure. We have the cases we have.
Sure.
And so, I guess I won't second guess the idea that people who are injured under the federal Constitution could go seek redress from federal courts for those issues. Now, certainly, I mean, the court here could have decided, and in fact has, Locke versus Davy. There's a case where a young man gets a scholarship. He's kind of there's this program that gives scholarships to bright students who get certain scores, and he receives a scholarship and is told you can use it on anything you want except religious education. And so I think, if I recall, Josh took a double major in religious education and business, but they said you can't get the scholarship because of religious education. That goes up to the Supreme Court, and that does come out that the way you've proposed, which in essence they say, sorry, it doesn't violate the federal Constitution. It's not an establishment. It's not it doesn't interfere with free exercise. And so if you want to change that, you'll have to go back to your state level. I think the breadth of Missouri's proposition here, which was even at the point it starts to interfere with public safety and welfare, we could draw lines based on religion. That starts to look worse. And so I think ultimately the court talks about at the point you're forcing people to choose between full participation as a citizen and their religious beliefs or identity or status, that is an Establishment Clause violation. So it's as long as we're not forcing you to be between choosing to be a citizen and being religious, then, yeah, we're going to make you work that out in the courts below in your state legislative process. But at the point that the government starts putting its finger on the scale and says, you know, if you really want to be a full citizen, if you want to have full power to vote, or if you want to have full power of protection of the state, or as we said, like Daniel versus Patey in Tennessee, if you want to have a certain kind of state office, you're going to have to give up your religious status. You can't be a minister to do that, or you can't be right. a church to get this program, or you can't be an adherent to this, that faith, or you have to, Sherbert involved unemployment compensation, or a Seventh-day Adventist didn't want to work on Saturday. So at the point the government is putting you the choice between being a full citizen, participating in government programs that are open to everybody, and your faith, the Supreme Court here says that's a choice the Constitution protects. We're not going to make you go back and fight that out. there may be some other things they do make you go fight out, but the government can't start cutting off your rights as a citizen, and then say, well, that's a special rule in our state.
Fair enough. Well, anything else we need to know about this case? I'll have a couple of follow-up questions, but what does the average American citizen need to know about Trinity Lutheran?
Let's see. I think one of the interesting things, I mean, I am hopeful that this approach to the Establishment Clause starts to take hold. I think this really begins to be a more textual analysis of the First Amendment. One of the issues I think I told the class is it feels like there's been lots of First Amendment jurisprudence has become an agglomeration of lots of different things. There's been lots of historical moments that have glommed onto the First Amendment. So we end up with, as I said, political slogans for constitutional jurisprudence.
Right.
Opinions still refer to the wall of separation between church and state. And while that is perhaps a useful political metaphor in some cases, or has been, and stood for a certain, perhaps, group of concepts, those were never in the Constitution.
Right.
And so we are not required to respect the wall of separation at the point of injuring children or citizens. That is, at that point, it has become a political slogan. And so I'm hopeful Trinity Lutheran represents kind of a return to talking about what we actually have, which is the First Amendment, not necessarily this history of social projects and various biases against law or against being religious in public.
Sure. Just as a sort of a concluding point here, did Trinity Lutheran Church get its playground?
As we sit here today, it has not yet received its rubber tire surface. I think last I understood, they're still resolving the last issues with the mandate. I don't want to speak to that right. Particularly either way, but
sure.
As of today, the answer is no.
So children are still endangered in the state of Missouri.
In Columbia, Missouri, that's true. Local children still risk.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. You're involved in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case as well, so we'll bring you back if you'll come.
Sure. Yeah, I wrote an amicus brief, friend of the court brief, on behalf of some United States legislators, and that case will be argued here in December.
Well, thank you again, John, for joining us, and thank you, listeners, for joining us. You've been listening to the City of Man podcast, part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipic. Please check out other podcasts in the family and get more info about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. You can also leave us a review on iTunes or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.